Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com, Community Progressive Radio, or new at iTunes. And I'm so excited again, as always, about the podcasting on iTunes thing. So today we have a really informative show. I know that economics is kind of a hard subject for most people. I know it is for me. And so I wanted to bring on an economist who really can make it accessible and understandable, and that's Dr. Richard Wolff. Dr. Wolff is a professor of economics. He's an emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, where he taught economics from 1973 to 2008. He's currently a visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs of the New School University in New York City. He also teaches classes regularly at the Brecht Forum in Manhattan. Earlier, he taught economics at Yale University and at the City College of the City of University of New York. And in 1984, he was a visiting professor of economics at the University of Paris in France at the Sorbonne. Richard Wolff, it's an honor to welcome you to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, no, it's great to have you finally on. I watch a lot of your YouTubes, and the thing I appreciate about you is the way you explain capitalism and socialism. I think a lot of times I go to a lot of socialist meetings around the world, and the Marxist jargon, the jargon is very daunting and intimidating. But I like the way you explain capitalism, especially your explanation about it like an old refrigerator. Can you tell my listeners about the analogy of capitalism as like an old refrigerator?
Yeah, I'd be glad to, and thank you for the kind words. I spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to make economics straightforward and understandable, which is what it originally was and what it was intended to be, a way of people understanding that part of their lives rather than some arcane special language accessible only to a few experts, which really
right.
which really is a perversion of what it's all about. Anyway, the metaphor of the old refrigerator, well, it goes like this. Capitalism has been the dominant economic system in much of the world for the last 200 or 300 years, and over that time, like all economic systems before it, it has grown, it has developed, it has spread from the places in the world where it originated to many other places in the world. It has changed over that time, and I would argue it is now getting old and feeble, and let me explain why. We are now in the second major collapse of this system in the last 75 years. Global capitalism fell apart in the 1930s, what we now call the Great Depression.
Right.
And then now we're in a crisis that started in December of 2007 and is still with us. And, you know, millions of people are out of work, roughly one-fifth of our capacity to produce the office space, machines, tools, equipment is sitting idle. And as a result of all these people unable to work and all this equipment being basically wasted, we're not producing goods and services that could go a long way to solving all of our social problems, rebuilding our cities, providing quality daycare, and so on. So this is an economic system whose malfunction, whose wastage, whose inefficiency is staggering. And between the end of the Great Depression of the 1930s, usually dated around 1941, and the beginning of the one we're in now in 2007, there were 11 more of these things. Well, it's like an old refrigerator. It's breaking down. It's breaking down more and more frequently. Its breakdowns are costing more and more in the way of lost refrigeration, all the costs of trying to fix it. At a certain point, the refrigerator repairman looks up at you with those baleful eyes and says to you, look, I'm going to be honest with you. You can throw another $50 or $100 into fixing this or that, But after a certain point, you know, you really have to recognize that it's time to say goodbye to a refrigerator that's worked real well for you for a while, but you're going to have to go to a new refrigeration unit or system or appliance because you just, it doesn't pay anymore. And I think we're at a point in the history of capitalism where its inability to function has gotten to the point where honesty and reasonableness would long ago, but it's better late than never, but in any case, it would long ago have justified us as a nation to get to the point of debating whether capitalism really is the best we can do as a nation. And I think if we began that debate, we would all be surprised by the outcome.
Well, not only has economics been made to be so intimidating to the average person, what do you like say to people who say that Obama is a socialist?
Well, I find that somewhere between silly and humorous, and let me explain. There's really nothing that Obama has said or done, for that matter, at least not as president or as a senator before that, that would justify throwing that kind of label at him, since he has celebrated capitalism from day one. I remember noticing that when I went to his website, when he was still campaigning for president back in 2008, and I remember clicking on the economics page, and they're seeing as his credo that economics are best if the private corporation is at the center of the economy, and it is the job of the government to make the best possible conditions for private corporations to do what to they do want. And I think that the truth of it is that he is a supporter of capitalism and that his regime, his policies have been consistent with that. I suspect that what people mean is that he believes there's some role for government, but that has never been a really contentious issue until Republicans use it for political advantage. The fact is that the government has been central to the American economy from day one. Even under the British, when we were a colony, the government was crucial, and after we became independent, the government was crucial. It is a fantasy of people, maybe it has good roots, but it's a pure fantasy to imagine that the government is not involved in every step of our economic system. Every large corporation in America, and I've had to do with plenty of them myself, every large corporation has a staff of people, economists, accountants, lawyers, and so on, whose full-time job is to figure out how the corporation's profits can be enhanced, either by getting the government to give them a tax break, or by getting the government to give them a subsidy, or by getting the government to decide on this or that project that will advantage the corporation. Every large corporation knows that it is importantly impacted by things the government does and does not do, and they busy themselves to shape what the government does to their own advantage. The notion that it is only poor people who are dependent on the government is unbelievably naive and simply stone cold wrong. Everybody depends on the government in this society. Every corporation, whether it uses the government's roads to get its inputs or its products to market, whether it uses the government-shaped and controlled airwaves to promote its products, whether it uses the government-run schools to educate the people it hires to do the work, at every point, the dependence in this society, in our economy, on the government is a reality of our economic system. It has been that way throughout our history, and the notion that we're going to get the government out of the economy is a kind of fantasy. And once you recognize that, then being angry at Mr. Obama because he has at least the straightforwardness to say that the government has a role to play, which is simply stating the obvious, to call him then a socialist is pure rhetoric. But here's the irony I think your listeners might enjoy that I've discovered as I travel around America. Large numbers of young people are asking me, at public forums, on call-in radio programs, and so on, they asked me, could you tell us a little bit about socialism? And I remember when this first began about a year or so ago, I was taken aback. It wasn't really relevant to what I was talking about, but it was clearly a sincere question. And after I answered it a few times, I began asking the questioners, tell me, would you mind letting me know why are you asking me about socialism? And here's what I got. These were mostly young people, I would say 35 years of age or younger, Americans, across the country, and they said to me the following. Well, I was watching television, and I saw this conservative, old, religious kind of person denouncing Obama for being a socialist. And let me tell you, I kind of like Obama, these questioners would say, so I figured if they're calling him a socialist, probably something to it, and I should go find out about it. And so I'm asking you. I thought that was unbelievably ironic that the conservatives' effort to denounce Obama as a socialist has done more to increase interest in socialism among young people in America than anything the left in this country has been able to do for 40 years.
Right. That is very ironic, isn't it?
Isn't it
remarkable? It really is. I get in a lot of debates with free market capitalists, and they say, that of course they're for the free market, and they're like the Ron Paul libertarians and things like that. And I was going to ask you, what would you say to them? But I think you already answered that question. But would you add anything to people who, because it has to do with the the new refrigerator, you know, what does this new refrigerator look like?
Yes, let me respond to the Ron Paul people. There have always been, in the history of capitalism for the last 200 or 300 years, people who looked at the system were able to recognize, if I can stay with my refrigerator metaphor, they were able to recognize that this capitalism that they really liked had become old and crotchety and would break down too often, and while they dearly loved it, it was going in a direction that wasn't very good. And they kept believing that if only you got back to the way the machine once was,
right,
you didn't decorate it with all kinds of new gimmicks, if you just got to the basic cooling equipment and the basic engine and all the rest of it, the basic motor, it would work fine. That's what the libertarian, they want to go back to a capitalism that was really competitive, when there were lots of enterprises in each industry who competed with each other and kept one another on their toes, when a kind of idyllic good old days of capitalism. And I understand what they're saying. There were attractive dimensions to early capitalism, even if they weren't quite as idyllic as they like to paint it. But I'm afraid you can't go backwards in history. The capitalism that they like is also one whose competition ends up with winners and losers. And those who win in the competition, who survive, tend to buy the machines of those competitors who've gone out of business and to hire the workers from the companies that collapsed because they couldn't compete. And what happens in capitalism, and this is true everywhere, is that many firms become reduced to a handful, and the handful then monopolize their industry to get together to secure their profits, and that then produces the kind of capitalism they don't like. But to go back to the old one isn't feasible 90% of the time. And here's the real irony. If you were able to go back and recreate the kind of idealized, competitive, small-based capitalism that they talk about, the mechanisms of capitalism themselves would undo that stage, as they have everywhere else, and move you into the modern one. So I think the solution is a different system. In other words, don't get another refrigerator that has the same qualities of this one that wore out on you. Look around and see if there's a refrigerator you could switch to, a different kind of cooling system, which would give you a longer life, a better life, a life with fewer breakdowns, fewer needs for repair, and all the rest. And so I would say, to put it all in a nutshell, and it's a book I've just written with the title Democracy at Work that lays all this out, it's that we have to finally be true to the so-called democratic principles we say govern our lives. And let me explain what I mean. We spend most of our adult lives, you, me, and most other adults, working.
Right.
5 out of 7 days we go to work, from 8 in the morning till 5 in the evening, if not longer. And that's where we focus our lives, and that's where we spend most of our lives. So if we're believers in democracy, the first and logical place where democracy ought to be established is in our workplaces. And what that would mean is very concrete. It means that the workers, whether they be 50 or they be 50,000, who work in an enterprise, who have to live with the results of the decisions made in and around their workplace, ought to be able democratically to participate in reaching those decisions. Workplaces, enterprises, ought to be governed democratically, and that means the majority should rule. We don't have that now. Our capitalist system, our old refrigerator economic system, has a very undemocratic structure. A tiny handful of people, usually numbering 15 to 20, are on something called a board of directors. Those people are picked by the so-called major shareholders, another tiny group of people. Together, these major shareholders, the owners, and the board of directors that runs the company, they make all the decisions. What's going to be produced, how it's going to be produced, where, whether in America, China, or who knows where it's going to be produced, and most importantly, what to do with the profits. And of course, they make those decisions. We all have to live with it. If they move the factory from Texas to Shanghai, we all have to live with the ruined lives, the broken communities and families that flow from that kind of a decision. If they decide to use some sort of toxic technology because it's profitable, even though it makes us sick, we have to live with the consequences. If they decide, which is very much our history in the last 30 years, that they're going to take the profits and give tens of millions of dollars to the top executives while everybody else has to scramble to basically get by so that we have a society increasingly divided between rich and poor, that decision is made by boards of directors when they parcel out the profits, giving most of it to a terribly small number of people, et cetera, et cetera. So my view is our problems as an economic system, to make a complex story simple, are reducible to the fact that we have a fundamentally undemocratic way of making decisions in the workplaces of our society. If workers together made those decisions, do you think the workers at a factory in the United States would close it down and move the factory to China? I don't think so. Do you think those workers would give a tiny group of people at the top of the company 90% of the profits so that they have wild multi-million-dollar salaries while everybody else is in trouble? I don't think so. Do you think those workers would use a toxic technology that made themselves, their families, their neighbors, the community sick, even though it made a few bucks more profit? I don't think so. In other words, I think as you go through the list of the problems we face as a nation, they would be, if not eradicated, they would be vastly closer to solution if we actually committed ourselves to democratically reorganizing our enterprises, to replace the undemocratic old refrigerator of our capitalist system with a new democratic worker-directed enterprise-based system. And notice when I say that, I'm not advocating that the government do an awful lot of things. I'm certainly not advocating that the government come in and tell everybody what to do. None of those old images of what socialism was a century ago are necessary for what I'm saying. I'm talking about a bottom-up, people-based change in our economic system, and not for some abstract ideological reason, but because look around us. We are living in an economic system that not only is inadequate to us, in terms of the wasted resources, the unemployed people. But worst of all, it's put so much wealth in the hands of a few at the top that they're able to buy and control our political system. So we have a dysfunctional political system based on top of a dysfunctional economic system. When that happens in the history of human events, it's time for a real change, and that's really what I'm talking about.
Well, that's perfect. We just have about 4 or 5 minutes left, but it was a perfect lead-in to my last question. Last year, the Occupy Wall Street movement arose, and I think they did a really good job of putting this income inequality question into the public discourse. I would like to see them, take the lead in moving closer to democratization of the workplace and democratization of the economy. Where do you see it a year later?
Well, I think that like all mass movements, Occupy Wall Street has strengths and weaknesses. First, the strengths. In a very short time, literally in September, October, and November of last year, they went from a brand new organization to a mass movement active across the United States in almost all the major cities. They, as you said correctly, they transformed our consciousness as a people. They put the notion of 1% versus 99% on everyone's lips. Obama had to use it in his convention speech a couple weeks ago, etc. So they've had an enormous impact. I agree with you. They are the beginning of the change we need. Now they've learned that the government can bite back, can force you out of a public park, can act as if you are not relevant, can pretend you never happened. That's normal. That's what happens. And they now have to regroup and recoup their lessons and make sure they understand how to make the next step forward and to make it more effectively so they can't be as quickly pushed off of the public consciousness as they were. This is a process of learning by doing. None of the basic problems that brought Occupy Wall Street into existence have been solved. In fact, many of them have gotten worse, so I'm very confident that since the problem remains, the provocation to people to do something remains, that we will either see a resurgence of Occupy Wall Street or the emergence of a new movement with a different name that will be deeply indebted to what Occupy Wall Street achieved. And if I can make one last point, American history teaches how powerful mass movements can be. The last time we had a mass movement like Occupy Wall Street that took the economy on was in the Great Depression. Then there was an alliance between the CIO, stood for the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the greatest unionization campaign and movement across America we've ever had before or since, signed up in a matter of months tens of millions of workers who'd never been in a union before, working together with the socialist and communist parties at that time, who were powerful organizations then. And here's what they achieved through their demonstrations in the same parks at the Occupy Wall Street 70 years later occupied. Number one, they got the president then to completely change his politics and to create the social security system, giving people who are over 65 a pension for the first time. That had never existed in America. That movement, the CIO, socialists and communists, they got the president to do that. They also got the president to create the unemployment compensation system that gives people who lose their job a year or two of support so they can find another one and get through a crisis that they didn't cause. And number three, and perhaps most important, Roosevelt created and filled 12.5 million jobs between 1934 and 1941. He was a president who went to the American people and said, if the private capitalists will not hire you, I will. And he put people back to work that allowed them to pay their mortgages, keep their homes, feel good about themselves, sustain their communities. All of those things were done by a president who was required to do them because of mass movements that basically gave him no choice. And that's only a small taste of what an aroused public could do here in the United States. Now we know that because it's done it in the past.
Well, thank you so much. And I will be sitting at your feet, so to speak, on YouTube watching you. And thank you for making economics so accessible
Well, I'm glad to, Cindy, and if you'd like to talk again in the future, just get in touch. I'd be glad to speak with you again.
I certainly will, but can you tell my listeners your website?
Yes, you can find out everything I do and get these books if you're interested. It's very simple, R.D. Wolf, spelled with two Fs, W-O-L-F-F, rdwolf.com. All of the stuff I do is available there at no cost whenever you're inclined to go there.
Well, Dr. Richard Wolf, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and I do hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you again, Cindy.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's our show for today. I hope you learned something. I know I really did. And seriously, go to YouTube or Dr. Wolf's website and watch his YouTubes. They're very instructive, very informative, but he's also very personable and he communicates in a way that I certainly appreciate. And with such a amazing resume, it's just I think very wonderful that he works really hard to make it an understandable subject. Well, as always, I'd like to thank Don DeBar from Community Progressive Radio, and he's the engineer for these shows. I'd like to thank Mikey, my producer. I'd like to thank Dr. Wolf for taking time to be our guest today. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening and for supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan, and you've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.